This is tape 3, side B. Another duty you have is administrative responsibilities, things like search and theses committees. Or maybe you don't. I don't know. Do you have those things?
Yeah, we do. We do have those things. We have relatively. We haven't had a search in a while. We have thesis committees are ongoing. There are a couple of other committees: admissions committee and information technology advisory committee. That kind of stuff. But these are again, and they're sort of monthly faculty type meetings that I attend, but it's really quite minor. This is as good as it gets in that realm. On the other hand, here it's not clear how one would have influence, for example, right? So that's sort of there's no, although one has few administrative responsibilities, there's really no clearly defined way to have influence on, you know, if there's no committee, then there's no formal way to sort of communicate through a committee. Mm-hmm. And so it goes both ways. In general, it's a good thing, I think.
Mm-hmm. You talked about when you started up your lab, getting an R01. What is the source of your funding now?
So I have Hughes funding, which is a big chunk of my lab. I have, and then I have some NIH grants, which is the other chunk, and then pretty much everything else has. I also have a McKnight, sort of a special award that's a technology development award, which is running out. But I have some NIH grants and some and the Hughes funding. That's the huge bulk of my funding.
Right. And you said earlier too that when you travel, the Hughes conferences, those are good. I mean, you enjoy those. You look forward to those.
Yeah.
Why those rather than others?
So what I actually like about them now is that they're a bit broader. So they're really now a bit more like the Pew meetings used to be. They're not thematically organized, but rather they're organized by whatever your schedule allows, and then equal numbers of people in each meeting. And one gets to hear a fairly broad range of stuff. And some of the talks are very, very good and pedagogical. That's the idea. Some are terribly technical. Especially immunologists have real problems with, I think, as a culture, with communicating their work. Mm-hmm. Obviously generalizing here, but to a general audience. But some of the people are making a great effort and are being very effective.
Right.
So you learn about things that you hear about things that you usually wouldn't hear at these other meetings.
This is sort of off the beaten path, but we're talking about, I think, teaching. You were mentioning that there are these summer conferences or workshops here at Colespan Harbor, and I've heard of them. I mean, they're constantly coming up. What is, I guess, the function of those workshops? I mean, I know what it would be if I were a budding scientist, obviously. I mean, Colespan Harbor has an incredible reputation, but what is the function of it for Colespan Harbor?
Well, you mean
what does it get us?
You know, that's a question that I've asked myself sometimes. But one thing that it gets us is virtually everyone comes through here once a year or once every 2 years. Okay, so that is really true. In most fields of modern biology. Then there are, so the meetings are clearly useful, and they have a long tradition, and they're sort of the meetings. Especially the symposium tends to be a very important meeting.
Right.
This is one annual meeting that is on a particular topic, like DNA replication, or you know, oncogenes, or learning and memory, you know, that kind of stuff.
Right.
Fairly focused, but it's the definitive meeting, I think, of often an era. And the courses are a little bit more difficult to understand because the lab gets grant support for these courses, and there are in fact lots of very, very good people who've learned their trade in these courses. I can actually, you know, I was a director of the Imaging the Structure and Function of the Nervous System course for 3 years, and I've taught in it for probably 8 years now. And there are already some of the graduates that I've seen are already beginning to have an impact in the field. So there is an impact. And oh, well, Rod McKinnon learned crystallography here, right? So you were talking about him yesterday, but that's, of course, you know, plastered all over the Cold Spring Harbor website.
Right.
And David Baltimore took virology here, you know, that kind of stuff. It is, but it is not a moneymaker, as far as I understand, and it is, I find the courses fairly disruptive. And they really take up a huge amount of space. They're only here 3 to 4 months of the year, but a lot of space is dedicated to them. They
right.
need teaching facilities. So it's not so clear to me how much the courses add on balance. But it's a long tradition, of course.
Right,
many of these courses are actually older than the permanent research program,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, the phage course is sort of, this is like early genetics, and it's been continuously running probably for, I would guess, for 30, 40 years.
Is it also, does Cold Spring Harbor also use it as a, I mean, maybe not directly, but, I mean, it brings all of these incredibly bright people, young, many of them, to
right.
the campus. Did they use it as sort of recruiting also?
Yeah, I think that happens naturally. I mean, it's
yeah.
a very, it there's just a huge flux of people through here. But I think the majority of, in terms of numbers, is through the meetings. The courses, there's a dozen courses, but they're tiny. They bring like 12 students in. And, you know, 30 faculty, I mean, the cost-benefit analysis is mind-boggling.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But it has a long tradition. And, yeah, I mean, just this summer, there are 2 applicants to my lab from the imaging course, you know, 2 out of 12. It's, I mean, I won't be able to take them all, but it is a recruiting tool by,
yeah.
And that is clearly very useful. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I agree with you.
All right, we've taken sort of a detour from funding. You talked about your funding and the sources of it. How much concern do you feel day-to-day in your lab's funding?
I've been very lucky this way. I have always had enough and some more. But I don't foresee that to be the case always. And one advantage that we have is that we sort of have our foot also in technology development, and the stuff that we're doing is considered to be of interest to many people. And so we have, for example, a project where we write lots and lots of software, okay, and we have essentially agreed to make it open source and give it away, and boom, NIH supports that,
mm-hmm.
because there's a call for proposals on maintenance and distribution of open source software. And then, you know, we got a whole bunch of letters of people who use our, so we've had lots of, I could have probably written 2 more of these and probably gotten them, just the money would be
wow.
coming out of my ears. And there's a fair amount of money for imaging and for technology out there, and probably for good reason, but we can tap that if we want to, and we have on a couple of occasions. So, then I have, you know, sort of 2 core R1s where I feel we are really leaders in the field, and I'd be you know, I really hope that that I have them for a couple of cycles. And then, of course, they have a natural life. And if I stop, if we stop being good at, you know, if we stop being top notch in that field, it's time to probably do something else.
Right. Yeah. And how much does the source of your funding, Hughes, NIH, others, how much does that shape the projects that you undertake?
It, well, it shapes the projects quite a bit because science, you know, I mean, I don't, so for example, mouse genetics, right, or something, we use transgenic mice quite a bit. We make mice, we breed different mice, we get mice from other people, you know, a cage of a mouse housing costs a certain amount per day. All these services cost a certain amount of day. A day. If you want to, it often is faster to do things on a larger scale, and you know, to, it's like that with many things, right? You want to immediately order 3 sets of primers rather than 1. You can do things faster when you have more money.
Mm-hmm.
And that is really that's really the main issue. I mean, that's often what you hear from Hughes people, that one of the things that it has liberated them from having to sort of constantly watch the bottom line, but rather and spending time on doing these kinds of calculations and just sort of doing things in a fast track and ordering that extra antibody and
so you can do it faster. Does it also, do you find that it leads to riskier science, people taking more risks?
Yeah, so here the NIH and the Hughes are sort of slightly differentiated, and
mm-hmm.
I think that the well, under Varmus, at least, the NIH has tried to emphasize innovation a bit more. At the Hughes, that is very explicitly the primary sort of category for evaluation, so of innovation. And so risk is really inherent. It's really a must. You have to sort of do difficult, long-range projects.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is to really fund stuff that NIH would have trouble to support. Now, do lots of people do that? Does everyone do that? It's a different question. Do we do that? You know, it's sort of borderline, perhaps. But
right.
We're trying to do things that we wouldn't have otherwise done.
Mm-hmm. This is a... it's going to elicit, no doubt, a subjective response, but I'll ask it anyway. Is there a correlation between those labs that are well-funded and also good, solid science, maybe riskier science? Do you find that to be the case?
Well, I think there's a correlation because the, you know, I it's by far not absolute. So I have always been surprised by how I've been on a few study sections, and every study section is sort of a different culture. In general, I think that the system is admirable. It works very well, it's
mm-hmm.
fair, and relatively efficient. But there are study sections that do not value as much as they should, perhaps, the sort of track record of the investigator. You would rather look at the proposal as such. And then there are very, very good scientists who can't put together a very effective grant.
Right.
So there are people who are not very good and who write a very good grant, and if they land that grant in the right study section with the appropriate culture, they'll get it funded. They may have had a solid track record, and so there are very wealthy individuals, or rather laboratories, I think, that are not, in my opinion, deserving of that wealth. And then there are absolutely fantastic scientists who live off one NIH grant by choice or because they're terrible at writing grants.
Right.
But in general, I think good science is rewarded. It's sort of, you know, there is a category in the evaluations that describes the investigator, which means the track record of the investigator, and that, you know, in various places that's sort of valued more or less.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and of course there's positive feedback, right? If you, everything else being equal, if you have more money, you can do things faster. You can try more things. You can do, in addition to your bread and butter things, you can do some riskier stuff and so on. So
mm-hmm.
it does, you know, spend wisely, it can produce good science.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It can.
Yeah.
Okay.
It can. Right. Right.
All right. All right. The writing process is another duty that you have, getting out journal articles. What is the process here for sort of originating those articles and then shepherding them through to publication?
In my lab, this varies a lot. Okay, so it really depends on number of factors, and I don't have a clear set of criteria, but there are articles that I find that are very important to the lab, and that, you know, where I've been involved very intimately with the design and execution of the experiment, where I would keep a very close tab of the writing, basically write the first draft and really dominate the whole thing from beginning to the end.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, that's sometimes necessary when I wouldn't like to do that. You know, there are, of course, you know, there are foreign students and also people who should be writing better than they do. I really think that's actually sometimes surprising how very, very highly educated people, how poorly they can write.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, sometimes you have people in the lab who write like gods, so
right.
it's there. They would write like them to write all the papers.
Right.
So it's, but that happens to be fairly rare. So I have one guy now who just writes wonderfully, and we're just writing together with him. It's just fun.
Mm-hmm.
We and then grad students, I tend to like to have at least struggle through writing one paper completely
mm-hmm.
from beginning to end, and where I just really make relatively, where I edit only if I absolutely have to, where I sort of make general general sort of comments, you know, go read about, go review your verb tenses,
right.
You know, and to come back.
Right.
And that kind of stuff.
Right. Learn the subjunctive case.
Right, exactly.
Okay. How do you know, I guess, when you have a paper?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's actually something that we and other people struggle with a lot, because there's of course a scientific the science should drive that completely, right? I mean, if you look back at the classics, it's absolutely clear. But then, of course, some types of science, it's absolutely clear. If you do crystallography, you know, structure defines a paper,
right.
The coordinates, and then you write a little bit about mechanism of the enzyme or of the channel or ion selectivity or what have you, what comes out of the structure. And that's not so clear always in our work. And so something like putting something together like Hodgkin and Huxley's papers on the action potential nowadays would be almost impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And there are so many facets in that paper that would have almost certainly been broken up in five or six papers, probably to the detriment of the whole.
Right.
But there is a need to break things up, and it's actually not me. It's usually more governed by the ambition and by the schedules of the people in the lab. And, you know, they really come now for just a couple of years, and then they want to start applying for jobs, which is reasonable, and they want a paper in that good journal. And so you do, you know, so you sort of sometimes think a little bit too much about how to package it rather than how to really finish it.
Mm-hmm.
And we're, and I think probably many other people sort of struggled with that. And so there are, you know, scientific concerns. Something has to be complete, and all the T's have to be crossed and the I's dotted in terms of controls and statistics and so on. But then there are larger scientific issues that have you really addressed a sufficiently large question? And that often, you know, I think falls short, I would say, to my taste at least. And, yeah.
And publications, as you know, play an incredible part in getting people positions in establishing your lab. Is that justified? Is that maybe the best way to do that?
That's a good question.
Serve that purpose well?
Yeah. I think it serves the purpose reasonably well, because, well, I mean, a publication should sort of reflect right, I mean, it's essentially fleshed out CV in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And it should reflect your scientific style, your scientific taste. The problem with publications are not just the ones that I just mentioned, but another one is that often lots of people are involved, and sort of individual contributions get lost.
Right.
That's especially true in some of the most interesting projects that develop, that require, you know, sort of expertise of many different, you know, many different skills, you know, mouse genetics, electrophysiology, some, you know, anatomy and so on, where different groups collaborate.
Right.
And often, sometimes it's not so clear who did what and when and in what order and who conceived, who had sort of the key insights. So, of course, letters of recommendation therefore play a very important role, which are also less probably useful than they might be, because they're nowadays sort of uniformly inflated.
Right.
One very rarely reads a letter that has a useful critique in it. And then, of course, if it does, it's a horrible red flag, even though it, you know, even if it might, even though it might be the most useful thing in the letter.
Mm-hmm. And then the person who writes it can be branded as, yeah, someone who's got an axe to grind, or
something like that.
It can be tricky. You described the lab management styles of the people, Odenk and Tank, mm-hmm. and others. How would you describe your own lab management style?
Well, I think that's really, I mean, you're asking me how would I describe my own lab management style, which is, I clearly have a different view of that than the people in my lab.
Right.
And there's no, I've noticed that a few times, but I, yeah, I'm fairly involved with what's going on in the lab, and I think they would agree with that. And essentially, how would I? Well, yeah, that will take some introspection, but I think that compared to, I mean, this is really, I think, more meaningful, sort of comparing myself to other people around, and I think I'm relatively hands-on, relatively often in the laboratory and pretty much on top of the primary data in most projects, and to the point, I think, where, you know, some people, you know, would prefer me to be less involved. It's just something that, for my own sake, I would not do a project if I wasn't as involved in the data analysis aspect of it, at least. So I'm less of a hands-off manager than many lab heads are, considering also the size of my lab, which is larger than 10 people. So there's more sort of a style that people with like much smaller labs might have.
You might have mentioned this already, but you say it's more than 10 people.
Yeah.
Do you know more or less?
Well, it's right now it's 15 people because there's a few people on the way out who are sticking around for a few extra months.
Right.
But that's sort of 10, 12 people is stable. 12 people is probably stable number.
And how do you usually run your lab? I mean, do you have things like weekly or biweekly lab meetings? Do you have journal clubs?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, we run a very, very tight ship. So we have every week we have a lab meeting where someone presents. The scheduled long in advance. We have...
you're looking at a float, not a... you're looking at a chart that has people's names on it.
Right.
Yeah.
And there's... and I try to, you know, if I go to California, I'd rather take a red eye than miss one of these, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
We had one today. Coupled with that is a journal club, so the whole thing takes 2.5 hours. And it's weekly, and pretty much everyone attends, I think it's fair to say. People submit essentially a presentation for everyone to look at, so those who are interested before or after the meeting can actually peruse the data. It's all on the, you know, on the web. We use a lot of web-based tools to, you know, share protocols and software and stuff like that. So we have a lot of... This is a management problem, a challenge a bit, but we have a fair number of collective projects, and I think programming is one of them, because we do a lot of instrument development, and a number of people write software. And it's a little bit like in a bioinformatics lab. One wants to ensure a certain style, a certain overall structure to the program so that they fit together, that other people can read each other's programs and are comfortable using each other's programs. So we have separate software meetings once a week for the 4 or 5 people who are doing software development, including myself. Then we have small meetings, so with 2 or 3 people who are working on related projects on a sort of fairly frequent level. So we have, you know, probably 4 or 5 of these in a week.
Right.
And that, you know, can last 2 or 3 hours.
Mm-hmm. And at these meetings, these weekly meetings, people present their findings, and then is it sort of a free-for-all, whatever questions people have, they can suggest techniques.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it's usually dominated by the people who are closest in sort of who work on related subjects.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been very useful. People get useful feedback and sort of, of course, questions and answers are very much encouraged. That's sort of the thing that makes it worthwhile.
Right.
Yeah, it's worked fairly well. Yeah, it's sort of, there's a culture that's developed that I think is fairly effective.
Right. And what do you think is your greatest strength as a PI, as the head of this lab?
Yeah, I think probably. I mean, I've again, it's difficult, very difficult to have a of course, a dispassionate view of that. But looking at sort of the track record and the kinds of things we've done and the also the kinds of jobs people from my lab have gotten is, you know, I think I've sort of matched people well with interesting projects that they were able to do and get recognition for. And I'm fairly effective, I think, at driving these things forward efficiently. I think that that's something that really, I've been in labs where they have done that fairly efficiently.
Right.
At Bell Labs, as I mentioned, and also at during graduate school. Just really thinking about what is the question here, what are the experiments that need to be done to address that question? Is it doable even? Can one get with what we have, the firepower that we have at our disposal, can we in fact address that question? And then, if so, how? And, you know, what are the different outcomes of different experiments? What's the strategy with outcome A, outcome B? And we're trying to really think through that. And I think that's, we don't dilly-dally. You know, we're really trying to get stuff done and you know, people publish and move on. And,
right.
And I think that's, has that more than anything else, I think, has sort of allowed me to attract very, very good people. You know, so, I mean, the people in my lab are very, very strong postdocs and students that,
mm-hmm.
that you know, because they see sort of a culture where they just see that other people were successful.
There's movement, there are results.
Exactly.
Yeah.
No one sticks around for more than, rare that they stick around for more than 4 years.
Right.
So, yeah.
And other duties that you have are professional services that
right.
sometimes are given, things like editorial boards, things like study sections.
Yeah.
Do you provide any of those?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm fairly active on study sections. I think that's an incredibly important service, and because I, you know, obviously I've benefited from it, but I think that it's a opportunity to shape science. It's an opportunity to really, you know, and it's just an absolutely essential service. Everyone should do it. At least sort of averaging at least once a year.
Right.
I think. Review a few grants, but I've also, you know, I've reviewed a lot for journals. I'm sort of an associate editor of the Journal of Neuroscience, but it's that only means that I'm sort of on call as a reviewer. Beyond that, I've not been very active in editing journals, and I don't see that really in my future.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right, you have two children, you're married. How do you balance sort of the demands of work here and family life as well?
That's a constant struggle, and it's something that, you know, my wife is fairly, you know, outspoken about drawing lines and so on. So that's helped a lot. And you know, reminding me sort of, I definitely, if I could, I spent more and more time here if left to my own devices. And of course, I really like to spend time with my children. And but it's, you know, one, there's so many things to do here. You know, if I sort of drift to being here more and more.
Mm-hmm.
So. We have sort of fairly, what I have now is a fairly fixed schedule that I've adjusted. I mean, it takes discipline, basically. Since I've had children, I've sort of adjusted my schedule in various ways. And the key change that I've done is sort of from being a complete night owl to essentially coming in at 6 a.m. and then not returning after 6 p.m.
Right.
That's been sort of the key difference, and really maintaining that. And, you know, I come in maybe one night or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then really spending time with the family those few hours in the evening. That's worked, I think, very well.
Right. Do you come in on the weekend at all?
Oh yeah, I come in sort of average one day, you know, sort of one normal working day weekend,
mm-hmm.
which could be one evening, one half day, or something like that. Yeah.
Right. We haven't mentioned your wife.
Right.
I was wondering, where did you meet her?
So I actually met her. I did mention that earlier.
Oh,
I did meet her originally when I was an undergrad, briefly, and then really bumped into her, as one would into an acquaintance in Cambridge. And
that was 5 years later. That's
That was probably 6 years later. Yeah, 5 years later, actually. Right. Yeah, probably 4 or 5 years later, actually.
Right.
Yeah. And that was, she was in a program there, and I was in a program there, and we actually graduated the same day.
Mm, that's amazing.
Yeah.
So. And what did you marry?
We married 6 years ago, exactly.
Okay.
Last week, 6 years ago.
So. Mm, so, good. An anniversary. Congratulations.
Right, thanks. Yeah.
And, is she a full-time mother, or does she continue to do science? Or
so she actually she's not a scientist. She was a business person. She was a management consultant for a few years, and then she did some other stuff corporate management. Well, actually, she worked for Sloan Kettering for a year as a sort of doing administrative work. So she's a freelancer now. She works from home, and she writes articles and mm-hmm. so on. And she's just written a book, and so she's clearly adjusted her schedule to suit family life much more than I have. But on the other hand, her job was was very demanding compared to what we have is nothing compared
really?
To that. Right?
Sorry to believe.
Well, they would give, they would travel for 4 days a week, first of all. This was completely standard, and every week. And they would sometimes have to give 6 presentations in a week about 6 different topics to 6 different audiences that knew really much more about the topic than they did, So it's sort of all these crazy pressure cooker situations.
Mm-hmm.
And, to the CFO of this company and the COO of this company and so on. And about manufacturing chocolate and about how to better do this and of course it was exciting and it's good baseline to do other things, but it's not maintainable. 5 years is what most people do that
right for. And then have a family on top
right.
of that
yeah,
yeah.
And women especially it's impossible. They
right.
just drop out.
What do you do when you want to sort of relax a little bit and maybe get away from the science? What do you do for fun and leisure?
Well, we have lots of friends. We have dinner parties, mostly with kids now, actually. So it's sort of a different different set of friends.
Right.
But so that's actually important to us. But I do almost every day. I do some kind of sports, running mostly.
Mm-hmm.
That's very important.
Do you run here around here?
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. We have as a matter of fact, they're running right now without me.
Oh,
yeah.
No, it's hard to take you away from that. It's hot outside. You want to go.
We do it pretty much every day.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's yeah.
And how far do you run?
Anywhere from, typically 7 miles, four or five times a week, maybe 4 miles once a week.
Right.
Yeah. But, I also play basketball. So depending, if I play basketball, I don't run that day. So
forward.
I'm sorry?
Are you forward in basketball?
I'm a point guard in my mind.
Okay.
But no one else seems to agree. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I like basketball too. I was always, in my mind, I was a center, but
forward.
So I couldn't quite get those to correspond,
right.
But that's okay. Anything else for leisure? You mentioned music earlier. You do that still.
But yeah, but it's on a really very, very low and inconsistent level, yeah.
Right, okay.
You know, I read a lot. You know, we're still sort of politically a little bit active, you know. So
So do you read in politics then? Is that
Yeah, but you know, we'll go register voters and stuff like that. But that's really occasionally, you know.
Yeah.
Very important this year, but
I see. Well, that's what I was about to say, but yeah. I'm glad you said it first.
Yeah.
Describe a typical work day, from the time that you get up to the time that you go to bed. I mean, I think you in some sense have. I mean, you say you get in here, or do you get up at 6?
No, I get in here pretty much right after 6.
Yeah.
And so I get up early. I basically 20 minutes later, I'm here. You know, there's no, you know. And then I mostly work here on some writing or programming or, because very few people get in before 9 or 10. It's actually very quiet in the morning, so you can rapidly and occasion also I work in the lab early on, but that I usually almost never do by myself. I always work with someone, so the early time is always some writing, something that takes thinking that doesn't doesn't really tolerate distractions too much. And then I might actually take home on occasion after the kids go to sleep. You know, I take a laptop home and continue that. But so then after, you know, sort of 9, 10, these sort of meetings start, meetings with various people. You know, I you know, wander into the laboratory, see what's going on, bother a few people. There are seminars and such, you know, meeting with speakers and visitors, and then working in the lab with people, mostly, you know, new postdocs or new students and stuff like that.
Let me put in a new tape and pick it up.